Welcome to this new Tech Captains podcast. I am Ron Dannenberg, and with Gareth Thomas, today we are joined by Ben Goldin, founder and CEO of Primary, innovating in digital banking engagement. For a bit of background, so Ben has an extensive experience, including his latest role before starting Primary at Mambu, where he shaped modern banking technology. He's a leader in digital banking and strategy, I think we can say that, and his insights and his insights are shaping, hopefully, the future of the industry now with his new venture. So Ben will explore your vision and your career today. Thank you for joining.
So much, Ron. Thanks so much, Gareth. Happy to be here. As we just discussed, I'm pleased to be interviewed by you already for a second time. That's a great honor.
Yeah, you're the first one the second time, right? So yeah, maybe we'll get some more of Ron's old interviews back on.
That's good. I mean, my first question then will be about Primary. Like, I'm interested in everything you've done, but I really want to know, like, what's your vision with this company?
Yeah, sure. So you can think of us as an operating system for modern customer experience in banking, right? Our platform sits on top of core banking infrastructure, core banking systems, both modern and legacy ones. We provide all the necessary components to enable banks build modern experiences, mobile web applications, conversational channels, wearables, so on and so forth. It works both for existing channels where banks would like to modernize something, but also for brand new initiatives, digital wallets or banks creating completely new applications for different segments, so on and so forth. And the reason why I'm saying you can think of us as an operating system, because like with any operating systems, you have things that are coming out of the box. If you buy Windows, you have calculator, yeah, Notepad, Paint, and things like that. But you also have a very sophisticated set of tools and technologies to build new applications. It's not always seen to a regular consumer, but obviously companies that are building applications, they're well aware of that. So we are the same here. We combine a best of two worlds, the world of buy, where banks can leverage out-of-the-box capabilities to accelerate their journey up to 80% faster comparing to building that in-house, and basically, well, leverage best practices from around the globe of what typical user journeys are today without reinventing the wheel, but at the same time, have everything they need to build what's unique. We call this buy for feature parity, build for competitive edge. Yeah. And the build part is equally strong as the buy part, right? And that's, again, back to the same operating system analogy, right? So that's basically what we do.
Yeah, but like I'm just trying to understand, because obviously like a lot of the terms and explanations you give can be abstract for people who are not familiar with banking technology. And that's why I'm sure you make a lot of images with the OS. And I'm trying to understand, like, because you were CTO for a while at Mambu. How does it compare exactly with Mambu? Is it a competitor or is it like a complement?
No, not at all. See, core banking systems are built for high throughput processing of data, creating transactions, calculating interest rates, being a main system to hold customer data, account data. Our system, our platform sits on top and kind of translates all this data and these capabilities for digital first use, right? For self-service use by customers of banks to be used from mobile web applications, WhatsApp, other channels. So that's the difference. We are complementary. We sit on top, and that goes not just to Mambu, but to any core banking system, modern and legacy.
I see. So if I understand correctly, and tell me if I'm wrong, you're more like the front end. You're actually the app I have on my phone that can do it. And behind that, everything that processes the transaction, that will be Mambu. So that's very
pretty
different
much
area.
Exactly. Pretty much that. Although if we would go a little bit deeper, we probably don't want to spend too much time on that, but just for 1 second, we believe that the actual mobile application or web application is something banks should be building themselves using technologies that are available today. And there's plenty of choices that are easy to use and fast to fast to learn and fast to implement. But at the same time, the backend infrastructure, the actual business logic behind these mobile and web applications, that's where all the complexity lives, and that's where it simply doesn't make sense to reinvent the wheel, and that's where we see it.
So that you have a thing on your website. I think it's you have the backbone product, is what you call it. So
correct.
Is that I'm taking it, that's like a tenanted solution then for each of your, you know, banks or whatever that want to build the application. Is that how that works?
Well, our platform consists of three main pieces. First piece, out of the box digital journeys that I mentioned just before. They are provided in the form of APIs and can be easily embedded into existing applications, or banks can build new applications on top. The second part is a marketplace of integrations with core banking systems and other ecosystem providers. And then third piece is what you are referring to, the operational backbone. And that's essentially the build part. That's the set of tools and capabilities that enable banks build their own new digital journeys using our architecture.
Okay. And then the marketplace. So with the marketplace, I can pick things that have already been pre-built and kind of drop them into the sort of front end sort of flow, the user piece of it. Is that how that works?
Cool. Yes, okay. That's correct.
Okay. And one of the other things I was going to ask you, because I saw the term for the first time on your website, was headless banking. I hadn't seen that term before. And so can you describe the difference between what I think is banking as a service and headless banking and open banking? Because I don't know that I didn't understand all of the differences between those different things.
It's a great question. Thanks for asking. Yeah, so we like to bring new concepts into market. Well, with Mabu, we brought in a concept of composable banking. Now with Plumery, we are doing the same with a headless banking. Well, headless might not necessarily reflect the actual meaning of it. You can probably call it faceless. That would reflect the meaning a little bit better. The point is related to what I mentioned just before. We believe banks should be free to build whatever face for their digital experience they like. They shouldn't be right. limited by technology choices or specific user experience choices made by vendor. And in order to achieve that, the architecture needs to be headless. Means we have to design our APIs and our digital journeys in such a way that you can easily, well, compose or create different journeys and build different faces on top of it, if that makes sense. And that's what we call headless.
Okay. And then what is the connection then to open banking? Because, I mean, obviously, that's still something out there. There's still businesses building in the open banking space. How is that different?
Absolutely. So open banking, to me, it's a channel, right? It's one particular channel how the external world can interact with a bank. And you can build that channel using our platform. You can build open banking channel as such, but it has to be offered by a bank eventually. Same as a mobile app or web app is offered by a bank. Open banking as a channel also needs to be offered by a bank. But in order to offer these channels and other channels as well, there has to be a technology underneath that enables that, right? And we are that kind of technology.
And what is the tech stack you've chosen to build at?
It's a great question as well. While working with banks generally, not just right now with Plumery, but also previously with Mambo and
earlier
with other companies. Yeah, well, exactly. What else? No, you got to be very careful with your choices. It needs to be, on one hand, simple enough and standard enough. But on the other hand, of course, you want to provide cutting edge state of art architecture and technologies, right? And that's the balance we're trying to keep. So, for instance, our programming language of choice is Kotlin, because it combines well two worlds. On one hand, it's a JVM-based language that most of the banks are happy to adopt, right? Java being one of the standard technologies for a while now. But at the same time, it's a modern syntax and a modern implementation of that JVM language that, well, makes developers happy, which is important. But also in terms of impact for the company, we can develop things faster. It's easier to learn. We can onboard people faster, right? So this is basically the strategy we follow. Also, when it comes to cloud, right, and it's a big topic by itself, cloud is, of course, very important, and every bank would have some sort of cloud strategy. But at the same time, there's a diversity. So we have multiple different choices of cloud providers. But also on top of that, for good or for bad, a lot of banks are still reluctant to adopt public clouds. They want to work with local providers in country. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole bunch of other reasons why potentially public cloud is not, well, it's not necessarily the best choice. Because of that, we had to implement our platform in a cloud-ready, cloud-based way, but also without hard dependencies on certain cloud-native services, right? So these are constraints we have in our reality, working in a, let's say, highly regulated, but also highly conservative industry. The second is even more important than the first one, to be honest. There's as much regulators imposed as banks themselves really are reluctant to adopt new technologies or new ways of doing things.
And when you were at Mambu, you were leading like hundreds of people, and then you move, you launch your own thing on day one, you alone, I mean, maybe with your co-founders. Like, how has this like impacted your leadership, your involvement with the low level tech task to do? Like, what difference have you noticed?
Well, certainly there is a lot of difference, but at the same time, I must say, I think, in my view, a leader should be able to zoom in and zoom out, right? Mm-hmm. You cannot stay on one level always. You always have to kind of zoom in and zoom out. So I was doing that in Mambu, zooming in into great details and zooming out to strategic topics and other things. And obviously now I do much more zoom in than zoom out, because yeah, we are relatively small and I have to go back to working on architecture myself, which is super exciting and nice. And generally, I kind of like to be involved in different things, right? So I call myself, it's not my term, I didn't coin it, but I call myself full stack executive, meaning one day I can do marketing. Yeah, one day I can do marketing, like the other day I can do sales, and then I can go deep and do some architecture discussions. I don't code, unfortunately, anymore. I would love to. Yeah. Maybe at some point I might treat myself, but haven't happened yet.
and so what pushed you to start this company? Is it that you wanted to work for yourself, you wanted to have another challenge, you wanted to go back to this zooming in, a mix of everything?
A mix of everything plus a long-term aspiration to change the way how banking is done. I think we discussed that a little bit during our first interview some years ago, right? I started my career pretty early and straight off in banking, and was always passionate about changing the way banking is done. And I think there's still quite a lot of opportunity to do so. I was building similar platform in another company, and I had a slightly different vision back then. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to implement it to a full extent. So I have this chip in the shoulder, as they say, as investors like to say, to kind of bring back my vision and finish the job I started back then.
So that leads me to the question: how did you end up into the bank tech world?
In general,
yes,
it was a nice coincidence, to be honest. I started when I was 15, 16 years old. And I was super passionate about computers and technology. And then I met one very visionary entrepreneur in Lithuania, where I'm originally from. Actually, I can name the company. It's called Five Continents. They are in business now for 30 years, I think. And I've met a founder of that company back then. He was super visionary and he was doing things completely differently. And he saw potential in a few young people like myself. So he gathered us together and gave us an opportunity to do things. And one of the first projects I did was actually an ATM assembly software, a software that would help banks assemble ATMs machines in a self-service way and order them, because one of the businesses that company had and still have is selling ATM machines. and software for ATM machines. That was super exciting. That already got me hooked into banking a little bit. The next project was analyzing credit card transactions and looking for error patterns and creating alerts, basically a monitoring system for POS terminals. And gradually, since that moment, all my subsequent projects, both in this company but other companies, was all about banking. And since I developed quite some experience and domain knowledge, I always wanted to double down on that, right, and leverage that. And that's why my career was always around banking.
So my first ever job was working on banking systems. I worked for a small software company in Wales, writing COBOL, and I suspect that there's some of my code still out there somewhere, probably. Just going back to the question about your tech stack. So you said you were using Kotlin. Are you using that on the back end as well for the back end services?
Specifically for the back end, because we are back end focused.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So I thought you don't have a componented front end piece for building these mobile apps then. You don't have that bit.
We have an acceleration mobile app, which is an app we give to our customers. If they want to have an acceleration, they can take it, change it the way they want, do whatever they like with it, just as a starter. But it's our value lives in backend services, in actual business logic, in actual digital journeys that are powering up these mobile applications.
Right? Okay.
So for us, mobile application, web application component that we offer is an optional thing in case our customers need a bit of an acceleration that they don't want to build from scratch.
Okay, I see. And then just when you were talking about the cloud, so are you saying that you don't use the public cloud? Do you have co-located servers where is that?
Oh, no. We do use public clouds, right? We are right now running on both AWS and GCP, adding Azure at some point this year as well. But the thing is, we need to support whatever cloud or whatever infrastructure our customers are willing to use, because we are not exactly a typical SaaS company, right, that offers some service in the form of APIs, and customers pretty much do not care where it runs. In our case, we need to be able to operate on the account of our customer, right? So our customer should be able to use their own cloud if they want right? Since we are platform, we are not exactly a service or a product that you can use straight off out of the box.
Okay, I get it. Okay.
Right.
All right. So you're on GCP, you're on AWS, and you're about to be on Azure then. So you'll cover all the big three.
Correct. Okay.
Yes. Ben, so ahead of this recording, you sent some two books that you really liked, and there's one that I would like to focus the attention on, which is the DevOps Handbook: How to Create World-Class Agility, Reliability, and Security in Technology Organizations, from Gene Kim, Patrick Dubois, and John Willis. Yes.
that's the book, yes.
Tell us more about it. Why this book? What have you learned from it?
So, while title might suggest that it's a very specific DevOps-focused book, I don't see it that way. I think this book actually covers the entire software development lifecycle end-to-end, and does it in such a way, how should I say, it explains the main principles behind Agile without calling out Agile, right? Focusing on the actual meaning of it, what it actually means and what's important about it, and doing that using a specific example rather than just putting on you some sort of theoretical narrative, right? So there's a very specific example, a showcase of a project and what was wrong with that project and what happened then and how they changed that. And there's a whole bunch of other interesting examples in the book itself that really help reader understand what is the efficient and effective software development lifecycle, what are important things within that lifecycle to consider, how to identify properly your bottlenecks and your challenges in the process and improve that. It's based a lot on, so it's written in a very similar style as a book called The Goal by Eliyahu Goldratt. It's actually a very famous book, was written quite some years ago, I'm not sure, probably around 40 years ago, explaining a principles of optimizing manufacturing, but also later on, there was a theory of actually, it's based on theory of constraints. So later on, out of the same theory, there was another theory, not theory, more like practice defined, called the critical chain by the same author, explaining how the same things are done in project management environment. So this book is very much based on these two theories, right? The critical chain and the theory of constraint, and written in the same style. So highly recommended.
So yeah, you wrote the last year's kind of flown by, so it might have been the year before, but there was a big article about Amazon Prime dropping serverless, right? And there was all these stupid comments, people saying, "Oh, it shows that serverless is rubbish and too expensive." And we actually talked with a couple of podcasts about this. You wrote an article about it, which I read, and it was very interesting. And you made two important points, right? So first of all, you said everything universal and easy should always be considered cautiously, as it screams complexity and lack of scalability in relation to step functions. And I thought that's really good. But then the second one, which I thought was really good, you said every technology decision is optimized for something at the cost of something else. So it's a trade-off. This is the main principle when deciding your tools and architectural styles. So my question is, I mean, you've been at startups, scale-ups. What is the best approach to these trade-off calculations? Because, you know, as CTOs in these positions, we're always making those. And in the early years, we're constantly having to make a trade-off. So, you know, how do you approach those kind of calculations?
I don't think there's a universal recipe to it. That's exactly the point, right? Same as there is no universal technology, there's also no universal way to measure trade-offs. You just need to be aware of what you are paying. It's more important to think, or I think equally important, to spend enough time thinking what are you paying for what you get. Because technologists, engineers, architects, even CTOs, we often tend to over-focus on benefits. Oh, this is great tech because it will give us X, Y, Z. And we spend literally no time thinking, okay, mm-hmm. what are we paying for it? Not in terms of money, but in terms of trade-offs, because there are always trade-offs, right? So the meaning of that statement that I made is that make sure you always spend enough time, if not the same amount of time, thinking what are you paying for the benefits that you are getting, and whether the cost justifies the value that you get in this particular context, right? Or maybe for that particular context, there's a better technology that maybe comes with slightly less value, but also with much more less cost that comes with that, right? So that's the idea behind. Always spend enough time thinking about trade-offs.
Well, I think one of the problems we have as tech people is we're like magpies. We like the shiny thing. Oh, what's the new tech over here? I'll go and grab it. I'll go look. It's really fun, right? But it's not always, it very often isn't the best decision to go with the newest, brightest, shiniest thing, right?
Exactly. Again, same thing. It might be good, but it always comes with a cost. And if that cost is justified and acceptable, fine. But you have to think about it, right? You have to make an explicit, conscious effort to think, what are you paying for it? Because even if you don't have that answer from the start, means you are missing something.
I think you're the first guest we've had on from Lithuania. You're the first Lithuanian. And I'm just curious, you're in London, though. You're based in London at the moment. Is that right?
No, not really. So yeah, it's a little bit more complicated than that. I'm currently in Portugal.
You're in Portugal?
Since
okay.
1 year.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah, since 1 year. But before that, I've spent 10 years in the Netherlands.
Okay. All right. But I was going to ask about the techs. I mean, because I don't know much about any of the sort of tech environment in Lithuania. Is there a tech, vibrant tech ecosystem over there? What does it look like over there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I would say Lithuania is probably somewhere in top three, top five countries when it comes to fintech specifically. And there's a huge amount of different startups focusing specifically on fintech. But not only that. There are quite some well-known startups coming out of Lithuania that are unicorns today. One of them is NordVPN. The other one is Vinted, a well-known secondhand clothes startup that are, well, marketplace of secondhand clothes. And there's a number of other ones as well that I just can't recall right away off the top of my head. But I think a lot changed in the last 10 years. Lithuania became quite vibrant and quite well known. There are a lot of companies establishing tech centers there. For instance, you may not know that, but Wix have a huge engineering center in Lithuania and a lot of engineering happening there. Uber, I think still have their engineering center there. Revolut used to have one, but I think now it's getting smaller in Lithuania. Banks, especially from Nordics, they have huge engineering centers and operation centers in Lithuania. Banks like Danske Bank, SEB, and a few other ones. So the tech scene and overall startup scene and fintech scene is quite diverse, quite vibrant, quite developed these days.
Interesting. And so why do you think that fintech has become such a big thing then in Lithuania? Why specifically that?
Yeah, I think it was a very deliberate strategy of the Central Bank of Lithuania,
okay,
and probably other governmental organizations that made an effort to simplify a process of getting licenses, EMI licenses, e-money institution licenses, banking licenses. And that attracted quite a lot of different fintech organizations in country,
mm-hmm,
including Revolut, by the way, that operates their European business out of their Lithuanian license. There's also a number of other organizations that maybe are less known, but are still quite established in terms of number of customers.
Okay. And do you have engineering teams in? Do you have people in Lithuania yourself, the current business?
Yes. So before Plumery, we did the same with Mambu. We established an engineering hub in Lithuania, and we hired, I think at some point we had close to 200 people working in Lithuania. Maybe not exactly 200, but very close to that number. Started from scratch, and we've built that hub in less than 2 years. Now with Plumery, obviously, we are not yet there in terms of numbers, but we have several people working from Lithuania.
Yeah, okay.
Including my chief of staff, by the way.
Thank you, Ben, for this overview. I mean, it was very interesting because I don't think we had many guests describing us the banking world, so... So it's a very obscure world if you're not from there, if you haven't spent time there. And for the information about the tech space in Lithuania, we wish you all the best with your venture, and we will follow it closely. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure being with you.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks.